Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Kitty Kengis, and each week on the show, we talk about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. In this episode, I talk with Sarah Imhoff of Imprint Architecture. She founded her firm in 2008 with a vision of balancing meaningful design work with a personal, family-centered approach. Her practice focuses on creating lasting connections with her clients, connections that often naturally evolve into lifelong friendships. This process reflects a bowerbird. This rainforest bird carefully constructs a beautiful stage to attract its mate. Sarah and her team thoughtfully design every project into a home that draws their clients in to live out their dreams. She curates the light, geometry, and details with intention to leave a lasting imprint in their lives. In this episode, we explore how her careful, creative approach, combined with incremental growth and a deep understanding of clients' needs, has shaped Imprint Architecture into a remarkable firm. Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I am your host, Katie Kengis, and today I get to talk with Sarah Imhoff of Imprint Architecture over in Stillwater. And she is doing incredible work, both residential and commercial. And you've built this niche practice that we get to talk about today. So welcome.
Awesome. Thanks, Katie. Happy to be here.
Sarah, we've talked before, but it's always fun to find another excuse to visit with you. Today, I'd love to hear more about how you've built Imprint Architecture and kind of that journey that you took to starting your own firm with your husband.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks for asking the question. And thanks again for inviting me to be on your podcast. And it's great to talk with you again as well. So Imprint, when we started Imprint, it was back in 2008. And the idea at the time was just a small business that I could operate and also start a family and do both at the same time. So be the master of my own schedule, the master of the budget, the finances, the clients, the design, everything that comes along with that, but also just small baby steps where we could start small and then slowly grow into maybe a business that was much bigger. Right now, we're 4, possibly 5 people, and it seems to be a lot for us, but we have grown a lot. And just by taking those baby steps that we started with, we found ourselves from 2008, what year is it now? It's 2025. So I guess, you know, in 3 years, that would be a 20-year business, but those baby steps have led to growth, incremental growth, but literally just starting the practice is just really out of necessity to want to start a family and just be in control of schedule and life and all of those things that come along with starting a family when you're young.
So what were some of the barriers that pushed you into starting your own that it just didn't seem like you could have the life you wanted working for someone else?
Great question. I think that the firm that I was at, they definitely had a good policy for mothers. If you were having a child and you wanted to go on maternity leave, or if you needed to start early and leave early because of childcare needs, they had all of that as a good policy. So that wasn't, I guess when I look back on it, that wasn't the main driver. It was the main driver, but it was also just the fact that I wanted to do my own design work. And I just loved being in direct contact with the clients and having that personal connection with them. And so at the firm that I was at, I had that personal connection, but it's a little different when you're not the, you know, you can't make all of the final decisions on your own. So that was probably one of the drivers. It was in 2008. So there was a market crash that was happening at that time. And our office was slow. I was lucky to have my position still at the office I was at, but we were on a 4-day furlough work week, and having some time like that gives you time to reflect and think about what you want to do next. When you're busy, busy, busy at work and all you can think about is what do I have to get done next week? Sometimes there's not space to take a pause and reflect on what you want to do for your future. But during that time, there was a little bit of space and we knew we wanted to start a family. And I definitely didn't want to be in a position where I had a newborn baby and then I was starting a business. So we wanted to do that, start the business sooner, kind of get it off the ground and then go from there.
Now, this resonates a lot. I remember I had my first two kids while working for someone else. And on the surface, a lot of it was well-structured for maternity leave and, like you said, the flexible hours. But there was just something about once the kids got a little older and I didn't want to have to explain to a client or have to explain through my boss to a client that, hey, there's dance on this like 10 a.m. on Wednesdays that I want to go to with my kid, or little things that I just didn't want to have to nitpickily explain each and every one. But if I could have a little more control over my schedule, and talking directly with clients was one way to get at that level of control, like you described, so that I could start to shape my practice. Because firms do have great policies, but there's just another level of ownership over your schedule, over your life, over the longer balance, like the rhythm of projects throughout the year, throughout the school year, throughout a summer year. Just when you're able to say yes and no and have more control, it seems like you can shape your family life a little bit more directly.
Absolutely. And then you also do get the time to spend with your kids as well. And so if it's leaving early to go to a play, or if it, like you said, if they're homesick, you know, as in the beginning, as a working mom, you never knew what the next day was going to hold. You didn't know if your kid was going to be sick or if somebody needed to go to the doctors or what was going to happen. And so you have to be on point. You get your work done, you know, a couple days in advance. And you just know that if you can never plan for, you know, you can never save anything to the last minute because you just don't know. And so to your point, being part of having that control over your destiny is a little bit more freeing and also makes it a little bit easier to raise children at the same time and be present with them. Definitely, as you know, as a working mom, it's hard to do both. But having your own company definitely makes it a little bit more in your own control.
And it's just one way to manage it. And I think for us, like, that's kind of how we found that balance. But what inspired you to call your firm Imprint Architecture?
So when we started, and when I say we, I always include Jeremy. So Jeremy is my husband, and he is a licensed architect here in Minnesota. And when we started, so that was 17 years ago, in 2008, when we started the company, he wasn't part of the company at the time, but we always had hoped that that would be the game plan eventually. When we went to name the company, we didn't want to give it our name because we didn't know what was going to unfold with the business. Would there be a partner eventually, or somebody that I might want to partner with if Jeremy decided that he wasn't going to join the company? You know, we wanted to leave the company open-ended in terms of names. So that ruled out having our last name on the marquee. But the word imprint really reflected the idea of what we do with architecture, leaving a mark on the earth, but also trying to be sensible about how we're leaving our imprint. And there's a lot of words that go along with that, like impactful and impressionable and, you know, all of these IM words. And our last name is also Imhoff. So an IM has this connotation of a responsibility of what am I doing for this, you know, architecture and world, and how is it all weaving together? So there is a few different ideas that were weaving together, and we landed on the word imprint moving forward, and also thinking in the future that that leaves the door open for team members that we have that work with us to eventually partner if they want to, or for us to sell our practice when we retire. What does that future look like? We're not sure, but not having our last name as the head title of the company was on our minds when we were thinking about what that future might look like.
And we're seeing that trend a lot in architecture firms right now.
Okay. I was going to say, you probably felt that same way, right? With your business?
I did. I needed my firm to be bigger than who I was because I didn't feel ready to start my own solo practice. So I needed something that I could grow into.
Yeah.
And I love how the wordplay and how the description and the impact of imprint really does resonate. And so does that play into three words that would describe your firm's unique approach, or are there other words?
Yeah. So our three words are imagine, implement, imprint. And that's a little bit about the process of every architecture company, right? Like we first start with that initial concept and idea, and then we work together and collaborate to create drawings that we can implement into the practice and what we're building. And then we imprint the project into reality. So those were our three words that kind of resonated from our business name. But we also have other words that we throw around in our office, like meaningful and empathy, empathetic, and trustworthiness, and all of those wonderful words too that we want to have and build upon when we have relationships with our clients. Because at the end of the day, we are designing something, but we're also creating a relationship with the people that we're working with, our clients. And we'll spend 2 years, 3 years sometimes. Sometimes it's a year in the design process and then a 2-year construction process. So these people that are choosing to work with us, we have to all feel like we're on the same page and doing great work for each other. And so a lot of the words we throw around in the office are almost equally based on that than just what we're designing and creating.
And I think that's wonderful to get into that aspect of the conversation, because looking at your website, you do have beautiful projects up. You've got lovely modernist design, a strong aesthetic that's carried across through all of these projects. And it does create an imprint. And it's great to hear that that comes out of a client relationship that is just as impactful. I'm curious, so what types of clients do you serve and what kind of projects do you take on?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I also love to, I want to touch on the fact that you mentioned our portfolio, but over the past 17 years, we've done a lot of different work, but it's really exciting every time we get a new project that's photographed and we put it up on the website. And we're like, which one goes up top? We love all of these children that we've created with our clients, and it's hard to choose which one is at the front and center. And it's fun to see now that we do have a body of work that starts to have a language that people might want to come to us for, because they see something in that they see a common thread throughout all those designs. So it's fun for us to kind of get to this point in our career where we're seeing that. And then in terms of the clients that come to us, we really get a wide variety of clients across the board. We get clients that are young couples, families. We have retired clients. We have clients that are thinking about retiring. We have projects. We also have commercial projects too. And those projects are like, we've done a funeral home and a brewery and a distillery. And in essence, those are like our clients' babies. And so it's not a quick turnaround project where they want to design something and sell it right away. It's something that they're taking personal you know, pride in what they're creating and designing, and it's meaningful again to them. So there's that word meaningful, but we have, so even in the commercial realm of clients, their projects to them feel like their houses or homes and in the way that they're meaningful to them. So yeah, the clients that we have, they range all across the board. And I think at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of amazing architecture firms out there. And sometimes I feel like the projects that we have, you know, they appreciate our portfolio, but they also feel as though they have a connection, you know, that initial connection when you're having that first interview meeting. And then also, do they feel like you're going to listen to them and you have that, you're engaged in what they're trying to do and what their vision is. And so I think a lot of times the clients that we end up getting, we have that initial chemistry, and then they want to work together and we love that. So, but yeah, we definitely also segue, we lose work to many fabulous architecture firms as well. And there's a lot of great, firms out here in the cities and even around the country. So that, you know, in terms of what type of clients, we do have a wide variety. Yeah.
I loved how you talked about there's that chemistry and that connection that'll happen. Can you tell me more about what are the green flags? I know there's beige flags and red flags nowadays, but what are the green flags for you when you know you're connecting with a client and they know that you're the right person to be listening to their problem and solving their problem? And you're using this family language too of like, these are clients who care about their projects. It's a reflection of themselves. They're imprinting on their own projects. So how are you connecting with them? What are some of the good signs that it's a good fit?
I mean, sometimes it might be a simple, oh, you know, so-and-so, or you, what work have you done? Oh, you've worked with that person. Oh, my kid plays a sport with their dad, you know, their kid's dad. We know him through sports or whatever it might be. But so sometimes that'll come up in the conversation and that is an instant connection. Or sometimes we have the same taste in an architectural style, or sometimes it's travel and they've been to a specific place that we've been to as well. And we have that connection over there. So a lot of times during those initial meetings, yeah, it might be more of a personal connection that we're talking about when we're getting to know them and what is your story and why are you here and what's your next chapter. And when we start to learn about that, a lot of times, you know, it's a small world. So a lot of times you just find those natural connections. And I think when you hit upon that, it just sparks an interest and an excitement and you want to work together. So there is sometimes even, it might even be a challenging site that for us is like a puzzle piece that we want to tackle or put together because it's fun and exciting and different for us. And then that, they feel that energy when we get excited about some of those things. And then, when they can feel our energy, then they get excited too. So yeah, I would say a lot of times it's a personal connection and then it's just learning about each other. And then there's also the architectural point of it as well.
I think that answers a great question that if an architect doesn't maybe always relate to their client, like what does it help to have that relationship with your client? Well, it makes the other harder conversations easier.
Yeah.
When you resonate at a deeper level,
right.
It makes it easier to talk to one another and tackle the hard things because you're aligning in how you're living your lives. You both travel or your value for community that you both have kids in sports or engaged in the community in that way. And it can happen in any type of architecture, but it's probably not going to come up when you're doing government buildings or
that's so true.
It's
true.
Other types of projects. Yeah.
prior to Imprint, I worked on a library, and that was fascinating too, because the librarians would be involved in the meetings and their library was their home too. It was their house. And so I would say one of my least favorite projects was a project where it was a development project. And then the question is, if I put in, you know, a refrigerator, a personal beverage refrigerator, will I get my money back, or I get twice as much money back? And those sorts of conversations that are just revolved, you know, purely around financial and money, they have less meaning and value, I guess. And also, you know, we're not interested in we always tell our clients, we're not interested in spending your money to a point where that makes us happy. We want them to be happy with their design, right? We don't want to get to the end of a project and they can't afford it, and then where nobody's happy. So we have to have these conversations, like you're saying, early and be able to be comfortable talking with each other about these things throughout the process. We've been doing this way too long to need to sell our services so bad that our client is unhappy with how much things are costing. You know, that's not of interest to us. So, I mean, I would say to your point, yeah, just getting on the same page with our clients is always exciting, and getting to the personal root of what are we doing? Why are we here together today? That's always interesting and exciting.
And to that idea of the root, something that's unique about your portfolio is that each project has a name, not just the name of the client, like your firm doesn't have your name. It's a bigger name that means something else. And then there's a story. And you talked earlier about there's a language that you've developed as a firm by practicing these 17 years. Can you tell me a little bit about what it's been like to have projects that tell stories? How does that story develop and come to be? And is it something that you create for marketing, or is it something shared with the client that develops out of the process?
Sometimes it's both. Usually, just like a person has a nickname, a house usually takes on its own personality and gets a nickname at some point during the process. It's funny because we might start a process and we might call it based on its geographic location, and then we might give it a name, and then it might evolve into a different name, and then or it might be the last name of a client. But when we're working on these projects and they have their own personality within the office, it's easy to throw around that name with each other when we're designing stuff, and just say, you know, oh yeah, Jewel Box Cabin, instead of the client's last name, or Lutzen, which we have multiple projects up there. Which Lutz project in White Sky? Oh, that's the name of the street. You know, that's kind of, it's more of the location of the house, but not the personality of the house. So these names, sometimes they evolve during the design process, and sometimes they reveal themselves once the project is under construction. So it is fun when something just hits you over the head with a name. I mean, sometimes there's projects where we just don't have a name, and it is just the geographic location. I mean, that happens too, and that's okay. But for the most part, it's just the personality of how these projects come to be. And when you see them sometimes being framed or even completed, and you're just like, oh, It looks different now. Like for the Jewel Box Cabin, I mean, there's so much glass and it's so small that when the lights are on inside, everything glows, and it feels like a little piece of jewelry in that sense, because of the way the light comes out of the house when all the lights are on and it's at dusk. And so it just evolved into a little jewel box, because you find like beautiful little things inside. And so that is where that name came from, but it wasn't always called that during the process.
I love that. And you also highlight the publications. Are publications a good way for you to find referrals or reach the clients that really love your work?
Absolutely. We don't do a lot of print advertising. We tend to submit for awards, and we love that if we can be featured for an award in Minneapolis St. Paul magazine or one of those magazines. That's always like a huge honor for us and super exciting. And so then on top of it, we get to go to, you know, event, whether we win something or not, we get to go to an event and see all of our colleagues and friends. And so we love those. And, other features. Yeah. So it's mainly a lot of times those awards medals are what is generating advertisement for us and getting the word out. And then every time you have a client, they might tell your name to, you know, two or three other people, and then it spreads. And so that we get a lot of projects through repeat referrals from clients and also contractors. And then we have done the Homes by Architects tour a couple times. That one is a little bit harder to do because it is a large investment on a company to do it. And then to ask your clients to move out of their house for a weekend and let 1,000 people come walking through their house is definitely, it's stressful on our end, but it's even more stressful on their end. So I don't know, we've done that a few times, and after we do it, every time we think, I don't know if we want to do that again, but it does lead to some work, and it's always nice to be part of the community, and it feels amazing to have a house that you can showcase your work to the rest of your colleagues in the profession as well. So have you ever done a home on the Homes by Architects or anything like that with any of your work?
No, my work is not. That's not how I get work.
Okay.
And I'm not in that residential. I love it though. I love that AIA Minnesota does this. I think it's really unique in the country.
Yes.
That we highlight each other so beautifully. And I volunteered for it a ton.
Oh, that's awesome.
And as a student and a young professional, it was a great way to see excellent design because, yeah. It's amazing stuff.
Yeah, they had last year, they started doing the small homes. And so they started implementing smaller remodels and renovations onto the tour. And I thought that was exciting. And so this year we plan to, as an office, just go around and have somebody take us around to all the houses on Saturday and Sunday and just look at everything and take a deep breath that we don't have to, you know, have everything perfect and greet 1,000 people that come through. So,
right. And when I was taking tickets, I would always ask people as they came in and out and put their little shoe booties on. I said, "What do you think?" And then I'd follow it up with, "Could you live here?"
Oh, I love that.
So many people, so many of the houses were just all glass, and it looks great in the photos and in the tour. And then you ask them, "Well, could you live here?" And it's like, well, kind of messy, and like there's not really space for that. You kind of have to live like you're in a museum,
yeah,
to live in some of these houses. And then others, it's like, yeah, definitely I would move in tomorrow if you gave me the key. So
yes. It
was a fun way to talk with the general public about these high design buildings and homes to see what they were taking away from it too.
Yeah, that's such a great question. I love that. We had two of the houses we had on the tour last year were totally opposite design aesthetics from each other. And so that would have been an interesting question to ask in terms of clientele, you know, could you live here depending on which house they went and saw, because they were so different from each other. But one of the reasons why we wanted both of them to be on the tour so we could showcase the variety of architecture that we like to do and how we listen to our clients. But two on the tour for a small firm is really hard.
It's a lot of hours and a lot of time that you're there at those homes. So very impressive.
Thanks.
And it's a selective list to be a part of. So congratulations on that.
Thank you. That's very nice of you. Thank you so much for saying that. Boy, you're blowing up my ego over here.
Well,
I got to do these more often.
That's the fun thing about finding birds for each and every person that I interview, because there are so many cool birds out there and they're just doing their thing in their way.
Yeah.
And
I love it.
For your firm, I'm torn because I have a standard archetype of a firm that's kind of a peacock, where you're a trendsetter and you have a style that you put out there and it attracts people to you. But actually, I think I want to get a little more niche for yours. I'd like to call your firm a Bowerbird.
A Bowerbird. Interesting. Okay.
So a Bowerbird, it's actually a rainforest bird. So you'll see it on the National Geographic videos, but they build a bower to attract their mate. And so they set the scene and they do all this work and they gather the materials and there's color and there's shape and they weave things, like they shape the grass, they create the space to attract their mate. And it creates an imprint the land that then it is permanent for a while to then create that connection. And I felt like that really reminded me of how you're reaching out initially and building this strong connection. You have this family language for each and every client and project you talk about, that it is this mating process and finding that connection. And then you go forward from there. It's also a very creative bird.
Oh, great. I love that.
Yeah.
I'm so like honored that you think of our company in that way, because it's hard to step back and think like, why did we get to this point or why are we here? And obviously there's an amazing team that has built all of these projects, constructed them, and the team that we have here at Imprint that have also contributed amazing design ideas and helped do the production and work with clients and all of that. So it's definitely a team effort, but I love to step back and hear what somebody else has to think about what we're doing, because sometimes you don't have time to step back and reflect on what are we doing here? What is happening? So I love that. I'm going to have to tell Jeremy about the Bowerbird. And do you play Wingspan? Did we talk about this?
Yes.
Yeah, because Jeremy and I love that game. And I'm going to have to see if I can find the Bowerbird in the Wingspan. I'm sure they have to have it.
There's so many expansions, though. I haven't gotten the others. So
we got the Asia expansion.
Oh, cool.
It's really great. Yeah, you can play a two-player version, which is really fun. Yeah.
That would be so helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's the Oceanic. And yes, I remember this. We need strategy game nights. That's a sign.
We do. Absolutely. I love that. That's fun. Well, thank you for that description. That's really neat. I love that concept. And I love that we're kind of building a house and creating a structure within the structure, you know, for the structure to happen. So that's cool.
And just the way that you're working with people and reaching out to them, it's also a functional thing a bit, because you're not just going all out, spending everything. It's responsible, it's long-term, it's committed. And I think that really means a lot. And beautiful projects and sounds like beautiful client relationships come out of it.
Thank you. Yeah, we do. We're so fortunate. We love our clients and we often end up becoming lifelong friends with these clients that we have. And to your point, yeah, we have projects that are just, you know, a $200,000 renovation, interior renovation for a bathroom and bedroom. And then we have a $4 million house. And, you know, all of them are special to us in their own way. And all of our clients are we're close with them too. And they're all special and unique too. So we still, even clients that their projects ended many years ago, we still get regular text messages and photos of the houses that we created for them and just how much they enjoy being there. So, and that's so rewarding and fun.
I love hearing that testimony. I know, not to put a marketing hat on it, but it would be beautiful to share those comments in those stories for these houses as well, because the words of your clients paired with
absolutely
the beautiful photos just makes it personal. And yeah, sometimes when we see these beautiful pictures of homes, we can imagine ourselves in them. But sometimes they feel impersonal to people who are like, oh, there's a picture of architecture. There's no people in it. And so it brings it back to that connection that I'm hearing from how you describe these relationships that you're building.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
That's a great idea.
So just to back up, we kind of touched on this in the beginning, but I'm just curious if there's anything else about your personal strengths, your hopes, your dreams that you built into this firm. and how it reflects who you are?
Well, I think at the end of the day, we hope that our clients are happy and they're satisfied and that they feel like they received value for the investment that they've made. It's a huge investment to hire an architect. Jeremy and I don't come from money, and we often talk to ourselves, well, who are these people who can afford to hire an architect? It's such a luxury, it seems like, to spend money on a designer. And so when somebody's going down that path and they're to that point where they want to hire somebody to design a custom home for them that they're going to live in for who knows how long, that's a huge commitment. That's a huge investment. We've had people ask us, well, what if we don't like it? What if we spend this much money and we don't like it? And so that's part of the process too, of checking in. And so we hope that at the end of the day, our clients have felt heard and that they enjoy their project and their home and it works for them and it functions for them and they feel like they've gotten every last cent out of the investment that they've made in hiring us and our services. And a lot of that too is just that personal connection. And we hope that we can continue to remain close with them even after their project is done. So I would say there's a lot of hope involved in what we're doing. And, that is our goal, for the future and what we're, basing our work upon is just hoping that our clients are feeling satisfied in a nutshell. Yeah.
Have your dreams for the firm changed? You mentioned you're about to cross the 20-year mark. Do you have different vision for the firm now?
Oh my gosh. The dream was always, if you could have talked to us like 20 years ago, if somebody said to me, I will pay you nothing and I will let you design me whatever you want, I would have said, okay. So, and our fees were like not that long ago were very low. And so maybe we grabbed one or two projects because our fees were low. But then hopefully our clients listened to us and we were allowed to express and share our design ideas and they bought into it. And we love that. And so now, we feel so fortunate that when our clients come to us, they're actually responding and asking us what we think, and they want us to be creative and present them with ideas that's outside of the box thinking. And we're getting to do that. We're at a point in our career now where we get paid to design things that we want to design, that we love to design. And that is just like, 20 years ago, if I would have gone from you pay me nothing and I'll design you whatever I want to you pay my living and I get to design whatever I want. I mean, wow, that's success to me. And then also getting to share that success with Jeremy, my husband and our kids, it's just like a dream come true. So we tell that to our clients a lot that hire us, like, thank you for continuing to allow us to do what we love to do every day. It's so rewarding. But did that answer your question?
It does, but it begs the question of, for architects who feel stuck in that grind,
yeah,
what advice do you have to help them get over that hump and get into this, what seems like a land of milk and honey, a dream world of a practice?
I wish we definitely have, running a business is not easy and it's hard and it's stressful and it's nerve wracking and it's anxiety inducing. And there's definitely a lot of stuff that comes along with it. So, but I would say, we were never interested in growing to the point where we just hired a bunch of people and took on whatever projects came our way to, just for the sake of saying we had a large company and having a large company. We weren't interested in that. And so I think if somebody's stuck, maybe reevaluate, what is it that what do they really need help with? Or what are they disappointed with? If it's just like, I'm not getting the type of clients that I want to get, maybe sit down and make a list of what is my marketing strategy and what am I putting out into the universe and who are my client types? What type of clients are coming to me? We've done that with our own business and it's been a huge eye opener. And then I would say if you're taking on too much work and you're tired, then maybe stop taking on all those It's really hard to say no. So hard to say no, but maybe pause and say, this project isn't serving me and it's not the direction I want to go in. So I'm going to say no to that job, even though it's really hard. And then I don't know, maybe if they're feeling stuck in a way that they feel like they need more help, for example, but they're nervous about hiring somebody because it's an expensive investment. The only way to do that is just jump. It's my best friend and architect, Nicole, she says, just jump. So there's no safety net. And that's part of being a business owner. Sometimes you just have to reevaluate what you're doing and what's not working for you. In the same way that when we do remodels for people and renovations, you know, we go into a house and they might say, for example, our family cabin. So it's very small and my mom likes to host all of us at the cabin and we designed it for them. And so everybody gets involved and they say, well, we need a two-story addition and let's put the bedrooms upstairs. Let's get more bedrooms upstairs. Or we need more space for everybody to sit in this living room. So let's add a deck out to the back. And so finally, I just asked one day, what's not working for you? Like, what is the one thing that is the problem? And she's like, I just need a table that everybody can sit around. And by answering that question, then anytime somebody says, let's do a second story addition, you go, no, that's not going to get you the table that everybody can sit around at the dining room. No, that's not the answer. So it's like just distilling down what's not working into like one or two things and figuring out why is that not working? And then tackling that, I think might be the best way if you're feeling stuck to try to get out of that. So I don't know, super long-winded.
No, that's the gold here. I think those conversations are the things we need to be able to have. And so how are you this expert that people are listening to? And then you're also able to tell them what they don't want to hear. And they take it.
Yeah.
How do you have that conversation of helping them be realigned with the values that you heard them say in their project?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that just comes with being older and having work under your belt. I mean, when you're starting out and you only have like a couple years worth of work, maybe you only have one or two projects that are built that you can put in your portfolio. So you're more hungry to get whatever you want. And then when you get older, you can just lay it out there and say, listen, I told somebody that, you know, they could do all of this and it didn't work out and I don't want to do that again. So, you know, it's life lessons. You learn. And so you realize that eventually just being honest and coming in like a meaningful way, not a blunt, brutal, you know, harsh way, but just being honest in a kind, meaningful way has much more value than, you know, not saying anything at all. So we try to do that and just tell our clients, this is what you need, or this is what you should do. And then hopefully they listen. And maybe sometimes they don't. I don't know. But yeah.
But I think we can't forget the beginning of this conversation, that you've already laid that groundwork and you're working with this person.
Yeah.
You don't have to tell them the bad news the first time. Well, sometimes someone calls with an unrealistic budget or timeline and you have to kind of like break it to them that
sure,
that's not really how things work on projects that I work on. Like, if you want a house by August and it's May, sorry, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. No, that, and that's true. Like we've done that in the past where they've given a, you know, we've only had 3 months and we're trying to get something done in 3 months. And then, so then we reflect back on that and we go, well, how did that work out? And should we try that again? And maybe sometimes it worked out, sometimes it didn't. I don't know, but you're right. Like we've already laid this groundwork and had this, pretty much been there, done that. So we can use that moving forward to see how it suited us.
And you're also, the groundwork continues with how you've connected with the client before they've hired you. Mm-hmm. And so you've already tried to build that relationship to be able to have tough conversations when they come up. And benefiting from the experience is such a huge, it's tough. All the friends I had in grad school, all of us girls were just waiting until our hair was white. Because that meant we'd made it in the profession. Because any famous female architect had this white, pearl white hair. And we're like, we need that. Then we'll have made it in our 60s.
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, it's just, we love our friend and mentor in the office here, Kelly Davis. And he's a former retired architect from Sala Architects, a principal there. And he has so much wisdom and he's been there, done that 2 times what we have. And so it's just great. I think the older you get, you know, the wiser you get. And yeah, it's age and experience is always a beautiful thing.
It is beautiful. Aging can be a wonderful benefit, especially when you carry those stories and share them so generously. The way any mentor I've had has been very kind and very encouraging. So I've just loved that about this profession, and they just want the best for the next generation moving forward. And so anyone listening who hasn't found those people, they are out there. There's tons of them out there.
Yeah.
Just go meet them and it's fun.
It's great. Excellent.
Well, Sarah, any other words of wisdom that you would like to leave our audience with?
No, I think this has been really fun to connect with you. And I mean, I would say just, find what you believe in and just keep working towards it. Just, you know, if you're feeling stuck, just ask yourself what is getting in my way? What's my roadblock? And then try to tackle it and baby steps. That's what we always did. And again, we're not a huge company by any means. We were small, but baby steps, you know, as the company grows, you just start saying, well, I need help with invoicing. I think we need a bookkeeper. So just baby steps. Like we don't, I guess maybe that's some words of wisdom that I would have is just understanding what you need help with. And it doesn't have to be everything all at once. It can just be, okay, small steps. And then once you get one thing taken care of that you're getting help assistance with, then you can start focusing more on the next thing. And it just grows from there. And that's how our company has worked as well. We had small projects and remodels when we started, but we documented those and we put them in our portfolio to build a portfolio. And it was an investment at the time. Every time we had to ask clients, can we get a photo shoot at your house? And, you know, you have to build upon something. So those baby steps, whether it's creating that online website or portfolio, even if it's not a huge project or multi-million dollar project, just put it on there, get it on there, create your brand, baby steps. Like we eventually just in the past couple of years had a brand marketing and book made, but we've always just done it on our own. So just small incremental baby steps, and eventually you'll build your firm and get to a point where you're doing the things that you wanted to be doing when you started.
And I'm impressed at how that seems to parallel the design process as well, as you're working towards this final outcome.
It does.
You're taking these baby steps, you're solving these little problems, and you do have a bigger vision in mind for the end, but you've just got to tackle it one detail at a time or one floor plan change.
I've never thought about it that way.
Yeah.
I think you're exactly right.
Architects are really well equipped to apply design process to business. It's just, it feels like a different part of our brain. And I think there's a way that we can use our problem solving to tackle business strategies in a more mindful way.
Absolutely. I mean, I know people go into business and somebody asked me one time, do you have, what's your, you know, 20-year plan? And I suppose I didn't have one. My plan was, I just need some clients so I can pay my bills right now. That's my plan. And by just working hard and doing what you love to do and working hard at it, now this, where I'm at now, 17 years later is would have been written on that plan. But like you said, that design process, that baby step process, just slow increments of getting there, sometimes that's more manageable than just starting to write out a whole business plan and figuring out how am I going to do all of this and where do I even start? I mean, that's, you just got to A, jump, take the baby steps afterwards and then go from there. So
great advice and scary advice for many, but again, trying to tell different stories and find the stories that resonate with people who are
right,
ready to try this and just don't know where to dip their feet in the water. So
yeah,
Sarah, this has been a delightful conversation. Thank you so much for your time. And it's just so fun to talk about imprint.
I love it. Thank you, Katie. Oh, and I'm so happy to talk with you again. This was so nice of you to include me in part of your podcast. And I'm honored and humbled to share my story and the story of Imprint and how we got to be where we're at now today. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I'm excited to see what the future holds for you as well. You're going to be busy.
It will be busy.
Joy Martin's story and architecture firm show remarkable resilience. Like the European starling thriving in a landscape far from its origins, Joy has navigated moves across the country. And since starting her architecture firm, she has been grounded in two different states. The starling wasn't native to North America, yet it flourished here. It learned new climates, new rhythms, new cities. That adaptability mirrors Joy's own journey, which brings us to our first point. Adaptability makes it possible to thrive in a new region, even without native roots. Many of us end up living far away from our roots, or maybe you've moved enough that you don't feel like you have roots anywhere. Yet businesses can still be grounded in their community. One of the most effective ways is by building relationships with local contractors, discovering who aligns with your values and your project goals. The architect-contractor pairing is the backbone of a successful project. We rely on each other to get it done well. When we assemble the right team and fly together, the client receives not only a better final product, but a better project experience from start to finish, which is our second point. Collaboration is key. Starlings are known for their dazzling murmurations, thousands of individuals moving together, sensing and responding to one another to form living shapes in the sky. There's no single conductor. The beauty comes from interdependence, awareness, and trust. That same spirit defines Joy's approach to design. Her process is fluid and responsive and attuned to the rhythm of her team and her clients. She listens first, speaks in her clients' language, and lets the vision evolve through shared momentum. It isn't about directing from above, it's about co-creating from within the flock. Because Joy cultivated that culture of mutual responsiveness, she was able to step away to care for her family for a season without losing the firm she built. Her team could continue the murmur, empowered, autonomous, and capable of flying information without her constant presence. For solopreneurs, collaboration takes on different shapes. We may not have an internal team, but we can still create our own kind of murmuration. My network of other sole practitioners becomes that responsive flock. Sometimes we team up on projects, sometimes offering guidance to one another, and sometimes stepping in when a deadline or expertise requires another set of wings. Collaboration isn't limited to firm structures. It's a mindset of shared lift. There's far more nuance within the world of sole practitioners than people often recognize. And that brings us to our final point. A starling may appear simply black, but like architects in our unofficial all black uniforms, when you look closer, you'll find an iridescent shimmer, purples, blues, and greens. Their feathers reveal depth when the light hits them just right. And that's the way our work can shine. Our work carries that same hidden radiance. From the outside, the architectural process looks standardized with schematic design, design development, construction documents, bidding, permitting, construction administration. We even call it SDDDCDCA for short. And this alphabet soup seems interchangeable from one firm to another. But in practice, each architect moves through those phases in their own rhythm, their own intuition, and in their own way of achieving depth. In Joy's firm, her projects may all seem elegant and thoughtful, maybe even look the same, but beneath each clean line lies a complexity that shows a nuanced understanding of her client's needs. It's in the layered design process, and it shows sensitivity to the unseen forces that make a space feel exactly right to those exact users. Even when modern projects look so similar on the surface, the architect knows the truth. Every design is quietly tailored to the lived spatial needs of a particular client, and our clients feel this too once they inhabit the spaces. This is a reminder to honor the depth of your own work. What may look effortless to others is the result of years of craft, listening, and growth. Just like the starling's plumage, our creative brilliance often reveals itself only to those who take the time to take a closer look. So if you want to fly like Joy, like a European starling, stay adaptable, cultivate collaboration, and let your hidden brilliance shine through. Whether you're navigating new territories, or building a network of creative partners, or just uncovering the richness within your own craft, may you move forward with that same grace and synchronicity, always attuned, always adapting, and always ready to fly. Season 2 of the Flying Solo podcast is sponsored by the Minnesota Architectural Foundation, whose mission is to invest in excellence, leadership, discovery, and equity within the profession of architecture. To join the Flying Solo movement, visit the website flyingsolo.live, that's flyingsolo.live, for links to our Instagram, Substack, and the Wingbeat newsletter, a weekly dose of birdspiration and practical tips to help you grow your business and your confidence as a solopreneur architect. While you're there, take the bird quiz to discover which bird best matches your solopreneur style. For even more resources and encouragement, you can find all the Flying Solo episodes on the Gable Media platform at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com, the premier destination for podcasts about architecture and design. And if you're looking for community, connection, and real conversations, check out the Entree Architect Network at entrearchitect.com. There's a link in the show notes. Whether you join one of their masterclasses or the free Facebook group, you'll find a community of small firm architects sharing ideas, challenges, and wins, proving that while we may work solo, we're never alone. As Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, says, it's all about doing better practice and better work every day. Thank you for listening to Flying Solo. I'm Katie Kangas, and my hope is to empower you, aspiring architects and creative entrepreneurs, to soar to new heights and embrace the freedom of flying solo.